Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome today students from Lakeland Union High School. Would those students please stand? Good, we're glad to have you today. You may be seated. Students are here with a program, a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Under the program, we invite students to come and listen to an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, they are given briefs in the case they are about to hear, and they may engage in activities relating to the case or to the law. They then come, listen to an oral argument, and usually at about 12 o'clock, they participate in a discussion with a justice, and that justice was Justice Crooks today. The discussion is about the procedure of the court, not the substantive issue of the case. So we're delighted to have you. Let me introduce the court to you all now. On my far left is an empty chair that is usually occupied by Justice Annette Ziegler. She is not participating in this case. Next to the empty chair is Justice Patience Flokensack. To my immediate left is Justice Crooks, Patrick Crooks. We've decided you're not John Roberts today.
But he's not decided. You may have decided.
Can't win all the time.
I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. On my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Her right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right is Justice Lewis Butler. I'll now call our last case for today, but we sit in oral argument on April 15th for our last case in April. 068P2842D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Paul W. Humphrey. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Humphrey is Attorney Lester Pines. Mr. Pines.
May it please the court, I'm Lester Pines. I represent Paul Humphrey, the respondent. Paul Humphrey did absolutely nothing wrong. He did not violate any rule of this court. Count one of this case focuses on an affidavit that he filed with the court in May of 2002. That affidavit was true. The affidavit stated that the state provided 84 pages of discovery material, made the photographs available to the defendant, and provided a scale diagram. The affidavit said that the state provided those things over 2 months before the date of the affidavit. The date of the affidavit was May 22nd. The arraignment in the case was March 12th. The photographs were made available to the defendant. The record in this case shows that the defense lawyer, Mr. Summers, knew that those photographs were available by availing himself of the well-known procedure for getting them from the Dane County Sheriff's Office. Tracy Wood, who is a former president of the Dane County Bar Association, testified that that procedure was well-known. So not only was it known to Mr. Summers, it was well-known to the defense bar.
Well, what's the procedure?
The procedure is that a request is made to the Dane County Sheriff's Office. Then a communication is made with the district attorney's office, and as a matter of routine practice, the district attorney's office communicates either in writing, by email, or by a phone call saying, go ahead and release the photographs. That's the process. And so the issue here with regard to this fact is, in regard to this affidavit, is that Mr. Humphrey did not say that he provided 84 pages of discovery material, that he provided the scale diagram, and that he provided the photographs. The district attorney's office, and the record is clear about this, the district attorney's office in Dane County is not responsible for providing the photographs. The district attorney's office is responsible for meeting its discovery obligation by making the physical evidence in cases available to the defendant if the defendant wants that physical evidence. That process is well known.
Had that evidence been made available to him over 2 months earlier when that affidavit was filed on May 22nd of 2002?
That evidence had been made available to him. That Mr. Summers did not avail himself of it, and that he wanted to see the pictures that Mr. Humphrey had in his file, was not Mr. Humphrey's problem. And the fact is that the photographs were available to the defendant.
But the photographs at the sheriff's department at that moment.
At that moment.
Yeah, at that, they were available. They weren't in the expert's possession. They were in the possession of the sheriff's department. And had I gone down, I would have gotten them. Or Mr. Summers gone down. Is that right?
And I want to make one thing clear, and the record in this case was clear about this. The photographs were taken and negatives were produced. The negatives are kept by the custodian of records, the sheriff's office. Anybody who needs copies of the photos gets them from the sheriff's office. The copies are prints made from the negatives. Anybody, the district attorney, the defense lawyer, orders the pictures, they're printed, they get them. Mr. Humphrey had gotten a set of prints from the negatives. He then provided them to his expert. But those weren't the state's evidence. Those were copies of pictures. Mr. Humphrey had gotten a copy. Mr. Summers could have gotten a copy if he had availed himself of that. The true statement is, that the photos were made available to the defense.
Did the circuit court get wrong then? The circuit court, in rather strong language, as I recall, said that it was totally disingenuous, quote unquote, to maintain that they had been made available, and that Humphrey, quote, close to quote, clearly misled the court.
The circuit court went down the road of assuming that it was Mr. Humphrey's obligation to give the pictures to Mr. Summers. And so when he looked at it, Judge Higginbotham, who, by the way, was not a witness in the OLR proceeding, and we actually can only surmise what Judge Higginbotham was thinking, but from reading the transcript, it's apparent that he believed that Mr. Humphrey had some kind of obligation to personally provide copies of the pictures to Mr. Summers. That's where Judge Higginbotham got off the track here. That was Judge Higginbotham's misunderstanding and misperception of the process.
What do you base your perception of the process on?
I base my perception of the process on the record in this case, which said that everybody knows that the way that you get pictures is immediately after the arraignment. If you want them, you order them.
Are we under the discovery statute here?
We are under the discovery statute, but that is the state's obligation is set out in 97123. The Dane County District Attorney's Office goes beyond what 97123 requires with regard to the physical evidence.
Okay. Under 97123, were these photos required?
Under 97123, the photos were not required unless the state intended to use them as evidence. That is, if the state intended to use them as evidence, they were required to turn them over.
The state had sent them out to an expert, right?
They had.
And one assumes that they would have sent them out in the supposition they're going to use the expert who would have to rely on the photos. And one of the problems is you don't know what's going to happen at discovery, whether you're actually going to use everything there after a trial.
That's exactly right.
I agree with that.
And that's why the district attorney's office says to the defense bar that practices in this county, after the arraignment, you're free to look at all of the physical evidence, photos or anything else you want. Just ask.
Does he ask to ask twice, once to the DA, and now does he just go to the sheriff's office, or does he have to ask the sheriff?
Ask the sheriff's office, and the record in the case says the sheriff's office then contacts the DA's office, and the record in this case is undisputed that the DA's office, as a matter of routine, communicates and says release him.
But in April, and I'm not going to have the exact dates in mind.
April 25th.
In April, they went, 25th, yes, that's the one I had thought about. Apparently, Summers went to try and get it, and they were not available.
No, on April 25th, Summers went after a hearing. He went back to Paul Humphrey's office where they were going to look at the photos together. Mm-hmm. Paul said, I thought that my copies had come back from the expert. They're not here. Summers got agitated, and then Paul wrote him a letter and said, look, here's how you get the photos if you want them. Did he have to write that letter to him? No, he didn't. He did not have to do that. That was gratuitous on his part. Thereafter, Mr. Summers availed himself of the process that was available to him as of March 12th.
What did he want? Did Mr. Summers want the photos, or did he specifically want the photos that were sent to the expert?
He wanted the photos. He wanted the photos. He ordered the photos. He got the photos.
So he made no specific request. That is, no request that the photos I want are the ones that you referred to your expert.
That is correct.
He asked for 5x7s?
He ordered 5x7s on May 10th.
What went to the expert?
8x10s. Mr. Summers was free, and the record is clear on this. He was free to order 8x10s from the sheriff's office if he wanted them. 5x7s are cheaper.
Let me see. You say that he was not entitled to the photographs under 97123 unless the state intended to use them at trial?
I believe that's what 97123 says. But it's really... Mr. Humphrey did not take that position. He made all the photos available to Mr. Summers, period. And that's what the Dane County District Attorney's Office does.
But let me ask this. When defense counsel asks for things under 97123, they don't have to pay for them, do they?
They have to pay for copies of the photos. Yes, they do.
Even under 97123?
That's the practice all over the state. I mean, the defense could come in and look at the negatives, and I suppose now that negatives are no longer used, I suppose they could come in and look at the digital photographs themselves. But the point here is that Paul Humphrey has said, this affidavit was true. This was my belief when I wrote it. It is true. But I have to say that to find him guilty of making a misrepresentation, there would have to have been some showing that when he wrote that affidavit, that he meant something other than what the affidavit said. The affidavit does not say that he provided the photographs over 2 months earlier. It says he made them available. Now, would it have been better if he had said, I made them available through the process that the Dane County District Attorney's Office has with regard to viewing and getting copies of physical evidence? Sure.
Counselor, did he call up the sheriff's department and tell him to give them to him when he stopped by? Is that how he made them available?
Once Summers said he was going to get copies of them, and that as soon as the sheriff's office contacted Paul Humphrey, he immediately responded and said, give him whatever he wants.
But he didn't contact the sheriff's office in advance. So at the time he signed the affidavit, he hadn't done anything with the sheriff's
office. He had not contacted the sheriff's office in advance, nor had Mr. Summers contacted the sheriff's office. And the point here is this, and I want to move on to the second count. The point is this. For Mr. Humphrey to be guilty of a misrepresentation, there would have to have been a showing on the record that he made a statement of fact, that the statement was false. We contend the statement was true. But if the statement was false, that he made it knowing it was false or in reckless disregard of whether it was true or false. And the record here does not support a finding. There has to be some structure with which we view the evidence in cases like this. And to accuse an assistant district attorney of misrepresentation without applying the facts to the law is completely improper. Now, with regard to count two has to do with an August 22nd hearing. And the fact is that Paul Humphrey made absolutely no false statement at that hearing. Here's what happened at that hearing. Joe Summers shows up at the hearing. He's got his set of 5x7 photographs with him. But he had subpoenaed Deputy Sewell to bring a copy of the 8x10 photos with him. Apparently, Mr. Summers didn't want to pay to get his own 8x10 copies, but he subpoenaed this deputy to bring an 8x10 set. That deputy shows up on June 7th for a hearing, but they don't get to him. He's got the photos with him on June 7th. They get to the August 22nd hearing. The same deputy, under subpoena, is supposed to show up with those photos. He doesn't have them with him. There's no statement in the August 22nd hearing, which is Exhibit 46. That's the whole transcript of the hearing. If you read the transcript of the hearing, it is obvious that the only thing that people are talking about at that hearing are the pictures that Sewell was supposed to bring with him. That's all that was being talked about. The photos were present in court, but they were 5x7s. Sewell was supposed to show up with a set of 8x10s, but he didn't on August 22nd. Paul is asked, do you have the photos? He says no, because he heard the judge asking him, do you have the photos that Sewell was supposed to bring? Sewell testified at the hearing. When I heard the judge ask that question, I knew he was asking about the photos that I was supposed to bring. And yet OLR reads the transcript differently and says that, no, the judge was talking about the state's accident scene photos in general. But that's a misreading, an absolute misreading of the transcript. But again, assuming that the judge actually was talking about some general photographs. The proof that was necessary in this case was to show that Paul Humphrey understood that that's what the judge was talking about, and that knowing that's what the judge was talking about, lied and said, I don't know where a whole set of the accident scene photos were. And there's no evidence that he did that. There's no evidence that he misled the court one bit.
This proceeded over how many months?
Well,
want the photograph available, don't get the photograph available, affidavits, several hearings. How many months is this?
Well, at this point in the case, at this point in the Raisbeck case, the arraignment was in March, this hearing on August 22nd. This dispute about the photos, what's 4 or 5 months already?
It just seems to me, let me do something just in a general way. When you read this, and it's part of my question, it just seems so odd that two grown people who are good lawyers somehow can't get together and hand over either negatives and say, what size do you want, or prints. And it seems to me that if the objective here is not, at least for the state's position, not to win, but to be sure that the correct person is charged and convicted of the correct crime, that if they had just picked up the phone and said, come on, let's straighten this out, right?
Well,
and
yes.
Then the next part of this seems to me that on the basis of my own law practice and reading enough records, but not necessarily this one, that when it happens that the phone isn't picked up, where you don't meet for coffee and do something, this sort of ill will between the parties, between the lawyers, and that these things escalate. Oh,
well,
is that what happened? I don't want you to go outside the record, but it just seems to me you got a problem.
I don't want to go outside of the record. So I'll refer.
Answer on the best of the
I'll
record.
I'll refer to paragraph 50 of the complaint in the statement of Mr. Summers. I have concerns of, let's say, the veracity of the district attorney's statements. He goes on to say, I believe I have a right to do it correctly. I don't want to take his word. I don't want to take his words that these are just photos. That's why we subpoenaed the photos. I don't know what's going on in Mr. Summers' head. All I know is that on May, at any time after March 12th, all Mr. Summers had to do was order a set of 8x10 photos if he wanted 8x10 photos. I don't know why Mr. Summers subpoenaed the photos, 8x10 photos. He could have just ordered a copy. He got his 5x7s. The state withheld nothing. The state withheld nothing from him. Mr. Humphrey withheld nothing.
Spines, let me ask, because I don't know the answer to this. At the actual trial, the underlying trial, were the photos introduced into evidence, and if so, by whom?
I don't know the answer to that. I believe the photos were, I'm sure the photo, some of the photos were introduced into evidence, and I suspect that some were introduced by the state and some were introduced by the defense.
And the reason I ask the question is, as I read the discovery statute, if they were photos that were introduced by the state, then wouldn't the discovery statute 97123 apply?
Definitely 97123 would apply. And the way that the Dane County District Attorney's Office ensures that it has complied with 97123 is by having a process by which the defense can get every piece of physical evidence it wants to review and copy immediately after the arraignment. So the defense is free to review it.
That's more or less, as I understand it, akin to kind of an open file policy, which is, and I think everyone recognizes that some offices have an open file policy, some do not. But that's different from the responsibility of responding to a discovery demand. And that's why I asked the question, and I honestly don't know the answer. But
well,
if there was a request, and if the state intended to use the evidence at trial, then it seems that at that point, the state has the obligation, and I believe there are cases out there that suggest that the district attorney's office is supposed to respond for the police department as well, to provide, as opposed to exculpatory evidence.
All I can tell you, Justice, is that but by the time this case was tried, the state had turned over every single piece of evidence to the defense that it was going to introduce. Nothing was withheld.
I look at count two not so much as did he or didn't he give it and when and why, and I see count two as pointed. The trial court, and according to page 7 of the findings of fact, the trial court asked the respondent whether he had the photos.
That's
the respondent
right.
replied as follows, quote, I have two photos. I don't know if these are the ones he wants, end quote.
Right.
At the time the respondent made those statements, he was actually in possession in his office of a complete set of 46 8x10 accident photos.
Right.
He was also aware there were another set in the hands of one of his experts.
That's
so
right.
Isn't that the essence of count two?
No.
Judge says... The judge asked him where are the photos. He says he has two. Well, he does have two, apparently, according to this finding. He has two, and he has three, and he has 10, and he has 12, and he has a complete set of 46.
Right.
And that's lying. What's wrong? That's the finding. So tell me what's wrong about that. That's what I see in essence.
The finding is clearly erroneous because the judge was not asking Mr. Humphrey whether he had somewhere a complete set of photos. That was not his question.
No, but it may not have
question,
been.
What,
it could have been non-responsive, but nevertheless, whether it's responsive or non-responsive, it appears, unless the quote is wrong, he said he had two photos.
Oh, right, but what I think the court needs to understand is that this was not a hearing about the photos. This was a hearing about a motion to on some other point. They got off on a
tangent.
Did he
say that he had two photos and when, in fact, he had 46?
He said he had two photos with him, yes.
But it was in court that he was responding to, not wherever they might be.
That's absolutely right. It was not wherever.
How can you show us that that was the import of the judge's question? Is it because the other man was subpoenaed and he didn't bring them with him, those photos with him, and then the question was asked of Mr. Humphreys whether he had some, and he said, I have two, meaning two here? Is that what you're telling
me? That's correct. Because the entire conversation was about what happened to the photos that this guy was subpoenaed to bring with him. And I urge the court to review the entire transcript and also the transcript of the hearing when I asked Mr. Humphrey directly, what did you understand the judge to be asking you? And he said, I understood him to be asking me about the subpoenaed photos. Now, if he was mistaken, Justice Bradley, that may have caused some confusion. That if he misunderstood the judge, then perhaps that's what caused the confusion. But that's not a misrepresentation, and it's not deceit.
Mr. Pines, was this the same judge, Judge Higginbotham?
Yes.
At the August 22nd hearing?
Yes.
Does the record reflect whether or not Mr. Summers was an experienced defense attorney practicing in Dane County? Because you've talked about the practice that's gone
yes.
on here.
The record reflects that. It is in the record of this hearing. Yes. Let me comment briefly on the third count and the issue of supposedly not timely turning over a report. That issue can be viewed very quickly and very clearly. Paul Humphrey first heard about the statement on October 21st. There was a trial scheduled on the 23rd, but it wasn't going to happen. A new judge had been appointed. There were motions. That was postponed. Humphrey got the report on October 27th, the same day that the Court of Appeals stayed the case. On December 11th, Joe Summers wrote to the court and said, I can't make it on January 20th, which was when the next trial date was, because my expert isn't available. Let's meet on January 2nd to set a new trial date, have a status conference. They set a status conference. No trial date is set at the status conference. On January 7th, Joe Summers gets the report. Then the case is set for May 24th. It doesn't happen until a year after that. So the defense had that document 15 months before the trial. And I contend that on that set of facts, there is no way possible that anyone could reasonably conclude that Paul Humphrey failed to make a reasonably diligent effort to comply with a legally proper discovery request.
Mr. Pines, when your time is up, too, you have time for a response. But I want to just pose something that's bothering me, and you can think about it, and we can discuss it when you're next up. This involves Mr. Humphrey and Mr. Summers. Mr. Summers apparently has his own case up before OLR, which ordinarily we might not know about, but there's been a filing. Should these cases be looked at together? This one, of course, is ready in the sense that the report's been filed, you've briefed it, you're here. Is there a reason that it should be held so it's looked at with the Summers matter? By this court held? If you want some time to think about that, that's
I can
okay.
tell you the answer to that is no. And the reason for my answer is that the behavior that you're examining with regard to Mr. Summers is vastly different than these allegations against Mr. Humphrey.
But isn't the behavior related, in other words, is at least as it's been reported, it doesn't the behavior that's alleged in the other matter come as a direct result of the facts that were alleged in this matter?
If about the same case, didn't it?
It's about the same case, the same circumstances, the same.
Well, Justice, you're asking me to tell you things that I believe.
But then we don't know.
I believe that the behavior
if
is not.
If they're not in the record, Counsel,
is not related to Mr. Humphrey's behavior, but is related to a trial strategy that Mr. Summers had from the very beginning of this case.
Yeah.
And his behavior then further reflected that trial strategy.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Bedker, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. My name is Bill Bedker. I do represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation as retained counsel in this matter. The record in this case is voluminous. We had a two-day evidentiary hearing last July. Several witnesses were called. Many exhibits were received by Referee Hansen. Dozens, perhaps as many as 60 or more, including numerous transcripts of the hearings from underlying cases, depositions, perhaps thousands of pages of transcripts altogether, maybe hundreds, but certainly voluminous. And with all due respect to counsel, I think to some extent he's asking you to sort of retry the case, and Referee Hansen has already done that in this particular case. He was in a position to weigh and judge the credibility of the witnesses who appeared before him and make conclusions as to what effect to give to the evidence and the arguments that were made by both sides. I want to start with count one. There is a difference between made available and simply being available. And I think it's a key difference that sort of gets muddied in the arguments of counsel for Attorney Humphrey. And I was trying to think of a good analogy to draw, and perhaps it's a corny analogy, but I'm thinking about the airlines because of all the things that are going on right now with flights being canceled and what have you. If I were to have a visitor come from out of state, take a plane to come visit me, I live in Watertown, some distance from either the airport in Madison or in Milwaukee, and as my friend is about to board the plane, he says to me, "Well, how am I going to get from the airport to your house, Bill?" I said, "Don't worry about it. I'll make available to you Tom's limousine service." I think the reasonable and the only reasonable expectation that one would have hearing those words when I get off the plane and deboard and pick up my baggage from the baggage claim, there's going to be someone there with my name on it, maybe Tom himself from Tom's limousine service, saying, "Come with me." I think the interpretation that they are urging upon the court essentially is that when you get off the plane and are in the baggage area, now you have to take this additional affirmative step and get on the phone and look up Tom's limo service in the yellow pages and dial the number yourself. So I think there really is a key difference here between made available and available. I also think that there is a conflict in the record between what's being said about the procedure and what the testimony was of Lieutenant Haney. He is, or was, the records custodian for the Dane County Sheriff's Department, and he testified at the trial. And I'm looking at pages 38 through 40 of the transcript in that case, and I asked him, hypothetically, is a defense attorney able to just come directly to you and say, "Hey, I represent Defendant Smith, and I'd like to get a set of crime scene photos from the Smith case." And there was an objection that was interposed, but ultimately the witness said, "No, they cannot." And I said, "Well, what is the general procedure? If a defense attorney comes in and says, 'Hey, I want to see crime scene photos from a particular case,'" and Lieutenant Haney said, "We will not give the photos without an authorization from the district attorney's office." So the district attorney is the gatekeeper, so to speak, in this particular case. And Attorney Summers testified at trial that he was consistently trying to get the photos from Attorney Humphrey. I think his testimony was that he tried approximately a half dozen times between March 12, when he filed his discovery demand, and that incident in late April, April 24 or 25, when they went to the district attorney's office and Summers waited in the lobby, and then Humphrey came back and said, I'm sorry, the photos aren't in my file. And he said,
could you help me with the dates? When did Assistant District Attorney Humphrey send a letter to the Sheriff's Department indicating, well, strike that. When did he send a letter to Mr. Summers indicating that he could pick them up at the Sheriff's Department?
My position, Justice Bradley, is that the first instance where we actually have a writing that Summers could take to the sheriff to get the photos was, I believe it was a May 2nd document. And that was talked about in the record with Lieutenant Haney. I showed him a copy of the exhibit, which was that May 2nd letter from Attorney Humphrey. Records Custodian Haney said, yes, we would accept this as a valid authorization, and had that been presented to us, we would have released the photos to Attorney Summers.
And then the hearing at which the affidavit was filed was on what date?
I believe it was, the affidavit was filed May 22nd. I thought that the hearing had occurred on that same date.
Okay. And the affidavit averred that the photos had been made available something like 2 months prior?
Correct.
What were the efforts? Obviously, May 2nd isn't 2 months prior to May 22nd. What were the efforts, or what does the record reflect regarding making available prior to May 2nd?
Well, I understand that prior to the arraignment, a defense attorney is not entitled to discovery. But this was an extraordinary case in the sense that Attorney Summers had actually attempted to subpoena the photographs during a preliminary hearing, because his position was, I've consulted with my expert. We know that these photographs, the skid marks or yaw marks on the pavement, have meaning. They're like hieroglyphics. If you know how to read them, they have meaning as to how fast this young man was traveling at the time when his car left the road in the context of this negligent homicide prosecution. Moving forward in time, he files the discovery demand March 12. He gets a packet of police reports. Summers does. And then it's not clear on the specific dates of each and every contact between Summers and Humphrey between March 12 and the April 24 or 25 incident at the DA's office where Humphrey actually checked the file. But the testimony of Summers was that he attempted approximately a half dozen times. These two gentlemen would see each other regularly at the courthouse, and comments would be made to the effect, when am I going to get the photos or when can I see the photos, that sort of thing. There weren't any specific dates placed on those contacts, but Attorney Humphrey himself acknowledged during that same basic time frame that, yes, in fact, there were one, maybe two contacts where things were said, but Humphrey said he was busy heading to court in another matter. His hands were full of files. He didn't have time to sit down and take a note, and then, according to Humphrey, Summers never followed up.
Counselor, did these two attorneys have any kind of personal antipathy that preceded all of this?
I don't know the specifics.
Not in the record? Is there nothing about
it? I know there was a reference, sort of a glancing reference to that in the referee's report. That was not something that we really touched upon at the trial in this matter.
Thank you.
At least not that I recall. Incidentally, these two gentlemen were also involved in a misdemeanor prosecution involving the same young man, Adam Raisbeck. And that misdemeanor prosecution was also assigned to Judge Higginbotham. So we have the same judge, the same defense attorneys, the same defendant in a misdemeanor prosecution. And Attorney Summers indicated that after this April 24th or 25th incident at the DA's office where there was a blow-up between the two about why aren't the photos here, that at some point shortly thereafter, Attorney Humphrey was more conciliatory and said, look, we have this hearing on May 1st with Judge Higginbotham, with your same client. I'll provide them to you there. Now, Attorney Humphrey denies that that ever happened, but Attorney Summers' position is that that information was conveyed to him, and when he showed up on May 1, that he anticipated that the photos would be provided to him there. And when that didn't happen, there was another, for lack of a better word, blow-up at that time. And then the very following day, we get the May 2nd letter from Attorney Humphrey saying, look, if you want to get the photos, here's what you got to do. Call Lieutenant Beglama, who was the records custodian at that time. Here's her phone number. As it relates to count two, the August 22nd hearing came on the heels, so to speak, of a June 7th hearing. And it's true, the record unequivocally shows that Attorney Summers had subpoenaed Deputy Sewell, who was the photographer. He was the guy that was actually out at the accident scene snapping the photographs, to bring a box of photos to the June 7 hearing. And one theme that sort of underlies the entire case as it relates to photos is how expensive these photos are to produce. And we don't want to unduly incur expenses on the taxpayer's dime if we can help it. And we went through the record, I thought, very cogently on this point, that at that moment in time, on June 7, 2002, at that particular moment in time when this box of photos was brought pursuant to Summer's subpoena to the June 7th hearing, there were only four sets of photos in existence. Three were ordered by agents of the state. One was the 5x7 set that was ordered by Summers. And I respectfully disagree with the supposition as to what the actual expectations were on June 7 and on August 22nd. It's clear that Attorney Summers doesn't trust Attorney Humphrey and other members of the District Attorney's Office, perhaps, at their word, and he wants someone on the record to go photo by photo to ensure that the state doesn't have something that he doesn't have. And they were arguing so much back and forth on June 7th that it's true they never actually got to call Deputy Sewell to the stand that day. But the testimony of Deputy Sewell was after that hearing took place, he's got this box of photos, and he had sort of been chastised by the records custodian for ordering up another box of expensive photos. And Deputy Sewell's testimony was he asked Attorney Humphrey, well, now what am I supposed to do with the photos, or words to that effect? At which time Humphrey said, Sewell had asked, should I give them to Attorney Summers? And Humphrey said, not unless he asks for them. That June 7, 2002 hearing was on a Friday. The following Monday, June 10, the record is quite clear on this point, there is this meeting with Attorney Humphrey, Deputy Nosinski, Detective Anderson, and the state's accident reconstructionist, Robert Krenz, where that box of photos was somehow transmitted from the Sheriff's Department to Krenz's office and left there. There were only four participants in that particular meeting on June 10th. As I said in my brief, it defies reason and common sense to believe that yet a fifth set of photos was somehow produced between June 7 and June 10. So when Attorney Humphrey is being asked on August 22nd by Judge Higginbotham, now do you know where the photos are? If in fact, and it seems to be his position, that his position is, well, I thought they were talking about the photos that were in the box that came to court on June 7th but were never introduced because we never even got to put on witnesses. He has to know that those photos are with his one accident reconstructionist, Krenz, at that point in time.
Counselor, I didn't understand opposing counsel's argument that way, and I did ask him a follow-up question, and what I thought he was saying is that he came to court with a couple of pictures, he himself, Humphrey. And that when the judge asked him, do you know where the photos are, he said, I have two of them, but I don't know if they're what he wants. And he was talking about what he had in court rather than the box of photos. Do you agree with that characterization? Seems you're saying something different to me.
It seems to me that they are sort of presenting an either-or proposition. At least that's the way I understood the argument to be. As I understand the argument, if what OLR is saying is that Humphrey was dishonest by saying, well, I've only got two, when in fact I've got 46 in my office. Then he understood the question to be, what do you have in your possession here in court? At other times, I've heard the argument to be, or understood the argument to be, no, Attorney Humphrey, when he was asked that question, thought that the judge was referring strictly to that box of photos that came to court on June 7th but were never introduced but ended up with Kranz on June 10th. And under either scenario, I think the bottom line is at this point in the case, here we are on August 22nd, we're still arguing about the same set of photos. I think the judge is exasperated and just wants to get to the bottom of this. So if Humphrey is saying that I didn't understand the question to be my personal set of photos, I understood it to be Kren's personal set of photos, I think it was dishonest for him to sit silent.
Say he didn't know where they were, right.
Right.
But yep. if he understood it to mean what he had in court, and he did have two in court, then he wouldn't have been dishonest, correct?
But I think if it's that limited, but I think that the question as it was posed was on the heels of all of this arguing back and forth about, I don't trust them. Mm-hmm. I think they're withholding stuff, Judge, to sort of put myself in the shoes of Attorney Summers. Mm-hmm. And Humphrey's sitting right there and hearing all of those things, and he could have easily clarified that. It's not honest for him to sit there and focus on the two when, in fact, he's got a complete set, and they really could get to the bottom of that issue that day in court, so they wouldn't have to keep coming back over and over again on this same issue.
Could you comment on what state of mind or perhaps mens rea, what intentional or otherwise state of mind is required for 28.4C?
It would seem that there would have to be a knowledge element, that I know that what I'm saying is not true, or I know that by keeping my mouth shut, I'm not helping the judge as a minister of justice get to the bottom of the issue of whether the state has more photos or different photos from what Attorney Summers has. As it relates to count three, the count for which OLR was granted summary judgment by referee Hansen, there is a difference between the discovery statute 97123 and the rule that we alleged Attorney Humphrey had violated on count three. And that rule, 23.4, says a lawyer shall not, in pretrial procedure, make a frivolous discovery request, well, certainly we don't have that issue here, or fail to make reasonably diligent effort to comply with a legally proper discovery request. He didn't make any effort to turn this statement of witness Kevin McCoy over for more than 70 days. Attorney Humphrey is not a new prosecutor. He is a highly experienced prosecutor. There's no doubt, the record is clear, he's prosecuted hundreds of cases, thousands of cases. I think his testimony that was unrefuted was over 300 jury trials or somewhere in that neighborhood. This is a negligent homicide prosecution where there's already been a lot of back and forth about whether the state is withholding evidence or not withholding evidence. Here we are in 2003 now, October of 2003, a year after the big fight in court on June 7th and August 22nd about the photos. And now we've got this new discovery issue with this statement that witness Kevin McCoy makes. And he attributes a statement to the defendant, Adam Raisbeck, that at some point in time during the spring after the accident had happened, that Raisbeck confided in McCoy that he was feeling very bad about what had happened, that it was foggy, he was driving too fast, he couldn't see the sign, and he drove off of the road. And in the context of a negligent homicide prosecution, that's very damaging evidence. And that was reduced to writing. Attorney Humphrey and Detective Greiber took this statement on October 21st, 2003, from McCoy. Up to that point in time, the only thing that McCoy had said about the incident was, I saw the passengers at 11 o'clock on August 31st, 2001. I don't know where they went after that. That was all he had said up to that point that was in the record. And now suddenly, here we are in October of 2003, and he's putting words in the defendant's mouth that are very damaging to the defendant's case. The statement on October 21st isn't reduced to writing until October 27th. In the interim, it's true, the trial does get adjourned, but also Attorney Humphrey, on or about November 12th, seeks a material witness warrant for Kevin McCoy. Now, the only reasonable basis on which he can classify McCoy as a material witness is based upon this October 21st statement, October 21st, 2003. And Judge Ebert does, in fact, grant the request for a warrant. And when Attorney Summers finds out about this in December of 2003, he gets very upset. He writes a letter to everyone, including the Court of Appeals, I think, and copies in Attorney Humphrey and says, how can they possibly classify McCoy as a material witness unless there is some additional statement over and above that original statement that he made way back on September 1st, 2001? Humphrey gets copies of these things, and he still doesn't turn the statement over. He still sits on this statement. And it isn't until January of 2004, after being directed to turn it over, that it is turned over. That's not a reasonably diligent effort. It may be true that, I guess to use a playground analogy, no harm, no foul, but that's not the circumstances under which we're operating here. His conduct doesn't even come close to reasonably diligent effort to turn this statement over. And that's why I think it was proper for the referee to conclude that based upon these uncontested facts that were set forth in count three, that OLR was entitled to summary judgment, that the effort wasn't reasonably diligent.
How often is there summary judgment in OLR cases? Do you know that?
I don't think it happens often, Chief Justice Abramson, but in all candor, I was only with OLR for about a year, so I don't have the frame of reference that others there do, but I don't think it happens with that much frequency.
Same rules apply as in any other case relating to summary judgment.
That's my understanding.
Counsel, we get cases about discovery in a civil and criminal context all the time. Complaints about the failure to provide discovery. And sometimes the court even imposes sanctions for discovery violations. When should those cases come to OLR? Or what are the implications of this case for OLR?
I think it's a very fact-dependent inquiry. And as I stand before you, obviously we could construct an infinite number of fact scenarios where we could say this one is clearly over the line and this one isn't. Looking at these facts, it seems to me that it doesn't even come close to a reasonably diligent effort on the part of Attorney Humphrey in October of 2003 to sit on this particular statement in this particular prosecution with all of the other issues leading up to that moment in time. But as a general proposition, I don't know that we can create a bright line rule. I think it is going to be a very fact-dependent inquiry.
Mr. Bedker, do you want to say anything about the sanction that's being recommended by OLR?
Justice Crooks, I did lay out in my brief the ABA standards, and I addressed seven cases that were most closely considered by the OLR director. And several of those cases involved attorneys who, like Attorney Humphrey, had no prior discipline. And in weighing and balancing those various factors, the director thought that a public reprimand was appropriate in this particular case. I know there were some 60-day sanctions cases in there, and there was at least one private reprimand, and it was believed that this one sort of fell in the middle ground between those two.
I just want to go back to Justice Prosser's questions, make sure I understood it. We'll get cases involving, it's in the criminal area, were you required under 971.23, which I think is narrower than the civil area, were you required to do it, you failed to do it, That's the issue. This case isn't whether the assistant district attorney had to do it or wanted to do it or part of the practice was that he could do it. It's, so I understand the case. It's that he was willing to turn over these photographs, but didn't. That's the allegation, didn't. And then when asked about that, intimated or stated, however you want to look at this record, they were always available and he did nothing to stop it. And the question is whether he misrepresented something. This is a code of professional conduct case.
Correct.
So happens it's an under 97123 is sort of the underlying statute through which the demand was made and the response was made. But it's that he lied, or the allegation is he lied, or misrepresented, if you prefer that word.
As it relates to the photographs?
Or? Yes. And yeah. Is there anything else involved here but the photographs?
No. I was just a bit confused because we also had the McCoy statement, and I...
Okay.
So just to clarify. Mm-hmm. Right. As it relates to the photographs, we're saying he was not honest. He was dishonest with the court, both in the affidavit of May 22nd and on August 22nd.
Mm-hmm. Aren't you a former prosecutor?
True.
Under 97123, does the defendant have to pay for certain things under that discovery statute?
I worked in a much smaller office in Dodge County, and our practice was to order up two sets in every case. Now, I understand we're a much smaller county than this, and if it was a public defender or a court appointment case, those photographs would be handed over without any bill attached to them. If it was a privately retained situation, there would ordinarily be a bill that accompanied the photographs.
Any other comments or questions?
One thing I was trying to look at is in regard to that statement. And if I understand you correctly, the request for it was made earlier with general discovery requests, and
True.
Nothing was forthcoming. And then after Attorney Humphrey obtained a material witness warrant for the production of this person at trial, that then Mr. Summers became concerned that there was information that he didn't have. Now, if there had been arrangements made and Attorney Humphrey were sure the witness was going to appear, he wouldn't have had to made any special arrangements with the judge, correct? So the only reason Mr. Summers was tipped off was because he wanted to be sure that he could compel attendance, right?
I think that's fair, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Pines.
OLR's argument points out the real problem that has infected this proceeding that it brought from the very beginning, and that is that OLR is making these broad statements about behavior and about conduct, does not tie those statements to legal standards. And its evidence was not tied to any legal standards, and I was hoping to hear in OLR's argument an explanation of how it analyzed from a legal standpoint the assertion that Mr. Humphrey misrepresented facts. Likewise, with regard to this discovery matter, Justice Prosser, you ask a good question. What standard is OLR going to apply in these cases? In this case, they applied no standard other than they looked at it, they said, we don't think this is reasonable. You have to look at the law that underlies the obligation of the district attorney. The law is to provide the materials that are discoverable under 97123 at a reasonable time before trial. 15 months is a reasonable time before trial.
Well, what about, do you have to, in the interim, if the judge asks you, do you have to tell him the truth? If the judge asks a question about discovery?
Sure, of course you have to tell the truth.
Okay. And your client told the truth?
Yes. My client was never asked about the McCoy statement. Okay. He produced that. It was produced 15 months before trial.
Counselor, but if there hadn't been a request for a material witness warrant, Mr. Summers never would have been beaten on his drum about saying, hey, I don't have everything and I already requested this.
That's true. But that doesn't mean that Mr. Humphrey didn't comply with the discovery statute.
Well, he wasn't very diligent if he had the statement all of those months after he attended that interview and didn't provide it until he was forced to provide it.
He wasn't forced to provide it. No court forced him to provide that. He was never ordered to provide it.
He didn't provide it until Mr. Summers accused him of not turning over everything, correct?
That may be true. That may be true, but that does not mean...
He copied, I think, the court on that letter, didn't he?
But it doesn't mean that he violated an ethical rule.
Well, how about a discovery rule?
He didn't violate a discovery rule either, because...
You think he was reasonably diligent not to do it at all, and then, you know, then to provide... I understand it was provided far before trial, but that was lucky for everyone, really.
Well, that's an assumption that you're assuming that he would not have turned it over had Mr. Summers not made a stink about it.
Well, I have to either take it two ways. If he didn't know he had it, and that's why he didn't provide it, then he never would have provided it, and you'd go to trial. If he knew he had it and particularly kept it without turning it over, that's the other choice, but then he only gets there by Mr. Summers pushing on him to the court.
I just want to warn the court that if you open up this Pandora's box, Mr. Humphrey had 500 cases he was handling.
Yeah, that's something that concerns me. I know
they
have
open up this Pandora's box that every time there's a delay in turning over a statement by the state in a criminal case, OLR can come in and accuse the assistant district attorney of violating ethical rules and put his license to practice law at risk. That is a huge policy decision that this court would be making, and I suggest to you it would be a serious mistake.
Well, it would be a serious mistake not to have relevant information in the trial of a defendant accused of a crime, correct?
That's right.
All right.
But I think the fact remains, regardless of why it was turned over well before trial. It complied with 97123, and that's the end of the inquiry. I mean, as I pointed out in my brief, a case where the state didn't turn over a statement until the day before trial.
Counsel, I want to focus on standard of review and take us back to count one. Count one alleges a violation of 20.8.4 sub C, and that is that the respondent engaged in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation.
Right.
It seems to me that the findings of the referee are in part credibility determinations. And those credibility determinations play into 20.8.4.C because the wording of that rule is, was the respondent dishonest or did they misrepresent?
Right.
Credibility. So given the standard of review, and our normal deference to credibility determinations accorded to a fact finder, how do you get us to a finding that the referee's findings with regard to count one are clearly erroneous? In other words, there's a standard of review.
The document speaks for itself. The English language doesn't change. The mere fact that OLR can produce a usage of the phrase make available that it believes the affidavit had and that apparently the referee accepted does not mean that that was the usage that Mr. Humphrey used and that that was the usage that he intended. And the referee did not make that finding. He did not find that Mr. Humphrey was untruthful when he said he made that usage. And in fact, had he made such a finding, it wouldn't be supported by the record. It's clearly erroneous. The affidavit itself, by using two active verbs, produced and produced, and one passive phrase, made available, supports internally exactly what Mr. Humphrey says he
well,
said. And so
I refer to pages 6 and 7 of the referee's report. And it says at the bottom of 6, top of 7, I therefore find that by averring an affidavit filed with Judge Higginbotham on May 22, 2002, that over 2 months ago the state made the photographs available to the defendant, and by continuing to maintain that factual position before Judge Higginbotham during the hearing, when in fact he knew that he had informed the defendant how to obtain the accident scene photographs less than 1 month prior, that the defendant did not actually have the photographs as of the morning prior to May 22, 2002. Why isn't that a finding that finding that he was misrepresenting? He said one thing when he knew something else.
Because that, if that's a finding, that's about as erroneous a finding as one could imagine. It shows that the referee had an absolute misunderstanding of the record. Because he says, when in fact he knew that he had informed the defense how to obtain the accident scene photographs less than 1 month prior, when the record reflects that Mr. Summers knew precisely how to get those photographs and had done it in other cases. That is irrefutable evidence in the record. And the referee utterly misunderstood or misperceived the facts in this case. This is as erroneous a finding as you could possibly imagine, because the affidavit doesn't say he told Mr. Summers 2 months earlier how to get the photographs, or that Mr. Summers was dependent on him. The affidavit says in passive terms that the photographs were made available, not that he gave them to him.
You're going to have to help me, and I just ask for a moment's indulgence. I looked at the May 2nd letter, and that's the letter from the respondent, Attorney Humphrey, to Attorney Summers, saying, this is what you have to do to get the records. That was on May 2. The affidavit was on May 22nd. The affidavit said those records were made available for 2 months, or at least 2 months.
I think, you know,
what am I missing there?
What you're missing there, Judge, is that, and as Mr. Bedker said, Mr. Summers wanted to see Mr. Humphrey's set of photos. He wanted to see Mr. Humphrey's set of photos. He didn't want to order his own set of photos. He wanted to see Mr. Humphrey's set. He bugged him about it. Finally, Paul sends him a letter saying, look, here's how you can get them if you want them. Finally, Summers decides, I'm going to order them. Why he decided then, we don't know. As soon as he makes that decision, Paul Humphrey sends a letter to the DA's office saying, to the sheriff's office saying, this is fine. But the point is, all Paul Humphrey was saying in his affidavit was a reflection of what the policy was in the district attorney's office. The structure of the affidavit was the state made the photographs available 2 months ago. The rest of this stuff has to do with Joe Summers making whatever decision he wanted to make and the timing of whenever he made that decision. The fact that he waited until May to get those photos shows the game that he was playing. He subpoenaed the photos for the preliminary hearing. He wanted them. He couldn't get them. Judge Bartel said, you can't do that. Then the arraignment happens. He knows how to get the photos. He knows all he's got to do is ask for them, and he knows the district attorney's office is going to release them. He doesn't do that. He plays this game saying, I want to see your photos. I want to see your photos. I want to come to your office and see your photos. And finally, when that blows up, he says, all right, I'm going to order a set. Paul McBall sends the note that he's supposed to send. Once the defense says, I want to order the photos. But were the photos made available to Joe Summers over 2 months before the date of that affidavit? You bet they were made available to him. That affidavit is as true as it can be. And that the finding of the referee is completely erroneous on that point. But beyond that, for the referee to even make a finding with regard to misrepresentation, there has to be a legal structure for analyzing it. And he didn't apply any facts that he supposedly found that we can divine from this to any set of elements as to what misrepresentation is. He didn't do that on count one. He didn't do it on count two. He didn't apply any elements with regard to the analysis of the evidence on count three either. And that's why we're here having this convoluted discussion about facts, is because nobody in this case, not OLR and not the referee, sat down and did a legal analysis and applied the facts to the law to determine whether there was clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that Paul Humphrey violated a rule. And we shouldn't be in a position here in the Supreme Court where we have to be having this kind of detailed discussion about this particular fact and that particular fact and this and that without someone up until today having applied the law to the facts. No one has done that in this case. And I submit to you that if you do it, you will see that there is no way that this record supports that Paul Humphrey violated the rule that prohibits misrepresentation or violated the rule that requires him to be diligent. And it's kind of through the looking glass to get to this point and not have OLR or the referee do that legal analysis. And I urge the court to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Pines, and thank you, Mr. Bedker, for your arguments today in what is always difficult cases for the court in terms of lawyer regulation. That concludes our hearing, 06AP2842D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Paul W. Humphrey. Court's in recess, and it will meet in closed conference at 3:20. And the court will meet again in oral argument on April 15th. Recess.